Comment has nothing to do with the Bible, but if Alma Rapport is here, she's asked to call her son. Yes, this is working, more or less. Now, every class session begins with a set of rules and methods of operation. I'm going to ask one or two things of you. The first is a little less commotion. We're trying to have an informal atmosphere here and coffee and a nibble, nosh. But I'd like to be heard. The second is that we're going to meet routinely at this 1 o'clock hour. I've heard that it conflicts with one or another of the activities of women in this town, but I'm afraid you'll have to choose between Dorothy Fuldheim and me. And I don't come on television every evening. And the third is I'd like you to bring a Bible, and preferably, advisedly, one of the editions of the many which has been published by the Jewish Publication Society. There are 100 different translations of the Bible. This is the one which has complete acceptance within the Jewish community, and it was one which will give us a little bit of uniformity in what we do. Now, can I be heard as we're getting across? All right. All of us have at least heard about the Bible. Some of us know a paragraph or two, a poem or two by heart. Most of us have made some opportunity in our lives to read the Bible, and we failed. We read a chapter, two, and then we tripped over the long, dry salt flats of the genealogical tables, the unpronounceable names, and we lost interest. Some of us went a little further until we came to the historical and to the mythological sections of the Bible, where we found that we simply lacked the necessary background information to grapple with some of the text. I think there's another obstacle to the reading of the Bible, one which is unique to the 20th century. And that is that, by and large, we have turned ourselves into hot rod readers. We seem to prefer novels that can be weighed rather than criticized. A 1,000-page novel is obviously the great American novel. If a man has something to say in 100 pages, it's a bit of fluff and very little. But to get through the bestsellers requires that we learn to draw our eye down the center of the page and pay very little attention to style and beauty of language, to the aesthetics of a book. We're quite confident that most of these books have only the most superficial of meaning, something that'll appear right at the surface to us. And all this speed reading hobbles us when it comes to the Bible. The Bible can be studied. The Bible can be dipped into. The Bible can be read a few verses at a time. But it can't be hot-rodded. As a matter of fact, we quote the Bible sentence by sentence. Each sentence is so pregnant in meaning. If I were to draw an analogy for you, I'd say that most of our literary material is like a Kansas wheat field. Mile after mile of the same. It doesn't matter much when you look out at the car window, you'll see the same sheaves bending in the wind. The Bible is very much like a New York City block. Skyscrapers, building of all heights, compacted humanity, a compressed chronology, a chronicle of the tragedy and the comedy of mankind. The Bible, each sentence of the Bible, each verse of the Bible, can be twisted and can be turned and can be researched for its basic meaning. And to give you an example, I'd like to begin right off by turning to the text to the book of Genesis, the first book of the Bible, into chapter 11. And by reading with you 9 verses. Does everyone know, by the way, how to find something in the Bible? Well, let me pause and divert. The Bible is composed of 39 books. Every pagination of the Bible is different, but every book is divided into chapter and verses. And so if we want to refer to Genesis, to chapter 11, to the part we're going to read, we'll say, return to Genesis. Chapter 11, verses 1 through 9. V is just one verse. We use the Roman numerals. That's one of the reasons, by the way, that we ask your children to memorize the books of the Bible in order. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Hosea, Joel, Amos, Obadiah, Jonah, Micah, Nahum, Habakkuk, Zephaniah, Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, Psalms, Proverbs, Job, Song of Songs, Ruth, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, Esther, Daniel, Ezra, Nehemiah, Chronicles 1, Chronicles 2. This way you can, don't clap, every child at confirmation time knows this. I just have to know to stay ahead. But it's one way to find yourself in the Bible. Now, chapter 11 of Genesis, it's a story, the familiar story of the Tower of Babel. Follow it, please, and let's read it together. And the whole earth was of one language and of one speech. And it came to pass as they journeyed east that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. And they said one to another, come, let us make brick and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone, and slime had they for mortar. And they said, come, let us build us a city and a tower with its top in heaven, and let us make us a name, lest we be scattered abroad upon the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the children of men builded. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is what they begin to do. And now nothing will be withholden from them which they propose to do. Come, let us go down and there confound their language, that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from thence upon the face of all the earth, and they left off to build the city. Therefore was the name of it called Babel, because the Lord did there confound the language of all the earth, and from thence did the Lord scatter them abroad upon the face of all the earth. A quick reading makes this seem to be nothing more than a story from the childhood of the race. Sort of an ancient version of Jack and the Beanstalk. Men propose to climb into the heavens. God disposes of man's plans. He will have no one contest his authority. And as punishment, man is shipped out to the four corners of the earth. But let's look at this story again. First of all, note that it involves a particular kind of building. We call it a ziggurat. The ancient Babylonians offered their sacrifices and had their temples at the top of a squared-off pyramid, much of this type. Those of you who have been to Mexico and have seen the Aztec and the Toltec and the Mayan temples will be familiar with this type of building. The shrine is at the top or near the top, and there's usually a rock staircase leading up. Now in Babylon there is no rock, there's only mud brick, and the cities competed with one another to raise their shrines as high, as close to the heavens as they could possibly get. God was above, and man must climb as close to God as he can possibly get. You remember from your art courses those wonderful series of pictures by Hieronymus Bosch, in which he shows bevies of ant-like men raising up the walls of this building, level by level and tower by tower. Now what's being said here? Not an architectural description of how the Babylonians raised their temples to God, but rather that all this is purposeless. that the proof of the virtue of religion is not its architecture, but its spirit. That what religion is involved with is not an edifice complex, but what happens within the religious structure. All this is superficial, purposeless. God has no will that man reach up towards the heavens. In fact, the purpose of religion, according to Judaism, as you well know, is what happens here on the flatlands, on the lowlands, where we live, and how we live with one another. So the first statement within this reworked myth is simply this, that the virtue of a religion is not its building program, the bricks and the mortar, the clay and the stone, the spirit, the internal life of the religion itself. Now, beyond this, we find in these 9 verses a brief excursus into comparative anthropology and linguistics. The Bible author had a problem. To prove the brotherhood of all men had to be created from a single pair, Adam and Eve. And then again, all men came out of the same pair, Noah and his wife, all the rest of mankind being destroyed. Obviously, everyone in the same family speaks the same language. But it was patently obvious to any Jew that he spoke Hebrew and the Moabites spoke the language of the Moabites. The Babylonians spoke Akkadian. The Philistines spoke a version of Greek. The Egyptians spoke Egyptian. How do you account for these many languages in this small area of the Middle East? So they created this story, which would explain the dispersion of languages. And there's nothing unique about this story. You'll find it in the mythology of the Babylonians, in a great cuneiform tablet known as Emunah Elis. But the Jews went one step further. The great power of their part of the world was Babylonia, which they called Babel. And they played with this word in Hebrew, Babel. And they said Babel comes from a Hebrew word which means the confusion of tongues. Now, what's the point? The greatest empire of the world is nothing more than a confusion of disparate peoples, a confusion of tongues. It is made up of disparate races and disparate classes. It has no unity. It is a confusing and mistaken thing, nation. It cannot, as the other prophets will say, survive. So we gained a word in our English language, a babble of tongues, and the biblical author was making a point deep within the text that the great empires of the ancient world had no principle of citizenship, no unifying purpose which draws them together. We could almost jump from that to the attempt in the last several administrations of our own nation to set a group of national goals which will unify a people and give us a sense of direction and purpose. Because a nation which is at war with itself is a nation which cannot long survive. And there's another idea deep within this text, deliberately put there. And that is that men, if they speak the same tongue, if they have the same language, the same sense of purpose, can accomplish almost anything. Look at verse 6. And the Lord said, behold, they are one people, and they have all one language, and this is what they begin to do. And now nothing will be withholden from them which they propose to do. The unity of tongues, the unity of purpose, can lead to the establishment of any and all purposes of civilization. Cooperation, the United Nations, a sense of the partnership of mankind in common purpose. If men can only learn to put aside all the artificial distinctions of race, of nation, of class, of color, and learn to cooperate together, nothing will be withholden from them which they propose to do. Now, I choose these 9 verses not because they are the most deep in meaning, but because we know from ancient sources the original Akkadian source of this legend. And we know that the things which the biblical writer added to and subtracted from this original legend. The original Babylonian text says nothing more or less than this. There was a great temple. Men proposed to raise this temple to the gods, and the gods destroyed it. And it was an explanation of why so many of these great Babylonian ziggurats were reduced by the rain and the weather, eroded away, though they had been raised to the gods. Now here we get theology and philosophy and morality and some politics and a plea for the United Nations and all that, all woven into 9 lines of a text that if we speed read, we dispose of as nothing more than a naive little myth by a naive little people in an off part of the world 3,000 some odd years ago. I'll give you another clue as far as your reading of the Bible. The book of Genesis comes first, but most of that which is in the book of Genesis comes last. The myths of Genesis are late. They come, most of them, many of them, long after the great prophets of Israel, long after Judaism has been refined into much of what it is today. They are not the childish tales of a childish people in the Iron Age of man. Or as I tell our youngsters in confirmation class, when you read the Bible, just make one assumption. Your ancestors were not dumbcuffs. They're not dumbbells. They wrote with deep perception, with keen insight. Try and look beyond and beneath and uncover. Now another thing becomes true as we look at these 9 verses. And that is that the background, the world, the science of the day is not our background, nor our world, nor our science. And we ought not to attempt to read back into the Bible and to criticize it from the point of view of research and discovery made only within our own lifetime or within the last century or so. The Bible was written over 1,000 and more years, beginning in the Iron Age, going down to the years of this common era. You need to understand something of the background, something of the world in which these men lived, to understand their purpose and their program. But why bother? What's the purpose of trying to have an afternoon such as this and a course such as this? The Bible, of course, is known for its aesthetic beauty as a literary work, but more than this. The virtue of the Bible is that it is the cutting edge of the greatest revolution mankind has ever known. The Bible gave to man a new view of himself, a new understanding of his world, and we're still living within that view of man and that understanding of the world. The Bible taught men to think in terms of the one God, the one world, the one society of men, human brotherhood. The Bible taught men not to be afraid of the gods, not to fear that the God would interfere for some reason known best to Venus or to Jupiter in the affairs of men. The Bible taught man that God desires not sacrifice and not punctilious ritual, but essentially and quintessentially the service of the heart, deeds, works as well as words. The Bible is not entertainment. The Bible is not fluff. It's not facile. The Bible tries to wrestle with the deep and the persistent problems of mankind, and it does not solve all of these problems. The rabbis say, hafoch ba, hafoch ba de kule ba. Turn it over and turn it over, and you'll find everything in it. And that's nonsense. You'll find a great deal in it. You'll find the wellspring of our Western civilization, but not everything. You won't find how to start a dynamo, or how to build one, or how to fly to the moon, or necessarily how you should best live your life and make this decision at this moment in time. You find here the broad principles: righteousness, justice, freedom, humanity, humaneness, sympathy, kindliness, and so on. The application you must find for yourself, and we must find with the tools of our reason in our own age. If I were to draw an example as to the nature of the Bible, I would compare it to our Constitution. The Constitution is the founding document of our American political way of life. There are those who say that our entire life must be governed by its simple literal meaning. And this is also arrant nonsense, because we cannot govern our lives by a few pages of text. Too much changes, too much happens too quickly. The Constitution must be interpreted. And what is the way in which a court interprets the Constitution? It seeks for its basic direction. It seeks for the road it took, its approach to a problem. And it tries to apply that basic understanding to the particular problems in the case before it. And so it is with Judaism. We are not a biblicist people. The Bible does not represent the summation and the consummation of all that we have and all that we have to teach. It sets the highways. It set us on our way. It gives us the guideposts, the basic principles. And then we must learn to apply these in our own lives. I would make one other point. These are all by ways of preface. The Bible was meant to be read. Now you smile and you think that I'm saying something which is platitudinous, but I am not. Most sacred literature was never meant to be read. The sacred books of the Egyptians, of the Babylonians, and even of the Greeks were reserved doctrine. They were set aside for the initiate, the man who had already been brought into the mystery, for the priest group. Sacred literature tended to have within it the law code of the tribe, what the tribe knew about agriculture, about the calendar, about the weather and the climate. This knowledge gave the priest group power. Knowledge is power, still in our own day. When a man, through his mind, has come to some understanding of nature, of science, we give him a copyright. We give him a patent so he can convert this information into dollars and cents. We lock it away for him. The ancients locked away their sacred books by taboo, by saying they were holy and they could not be read openly. They were locked away in the temples and only available to the priest group. This assured the priest group of the tithes, of the taxes, of the sacrifices, of all that kept their privileges in line. And many of you may have seen the play Luther when it appeared here last year or in New York. And you'll remember that as late as the 16th century, the Roman Catholic Church was still locking away the Bible from ordinary reading. To translate the Bible into a spoken language, into the vernacular, was heresy. The Bible could be read, but in Latin or in Hebrew. And who among the peasants of Central Europe knew Latin or Hebrew? Religions have always had a compulsion to assure themselves of orthodoxy, that men would believe and agree to that which the religious leadership, the hierarchy, handed down and insisted upon. Because religions, with the exception of Judaism, have tend to emphasize right belief. By believing certain things, you assured yourself of salvation. Obviously, if you believed the wrong thing, the untruth, you were denying yourself the road to salvation. In the 12th and the 13th and the 14th century, hundreds of men were burned at the stake in France and Spain and Italy for no other crime than that they translated the Bible into Catalan or Castilian or Provençal or French or Italian. Now, when I take the Torah from the Ark on Saturday morning, I recite a formula which is ancient in our people. Torah tziva lanu Moshe morasha kihilas Yaakov. This is the Torah which God commanded us through Moses. It is the inheritance of the whole congregation of Israel. And it has been the immemorial practice of our people to take the Torah scrolls from the Ark and to read them Shabbos morning, Mondays and Thursdays, on the holidays and regularly. And in the ancient synagogues, there was a man who stood right next to the reader at the platform. And as the reader read the Hebrew, which was then no longer understood, this man, who was called a meturgeman, immediately translated the text into whatever the spoken language may have been, Arabic, Aramaic, Greek, or the like. Our people were desperately concerned that this book should be read and it should be understood. Now we have a strange fact of history here. In our colleges we're told that scientific observation and classification comes to us from the Greeks, and this is true. But if you read Aristotle or you read Plato, you'll find that they wrote in a cipher, in a code, which could be known only to the initiate, that they insisted that there were certain philosophic materials which were reserved to the philosopher, which could not be told to the ordinary people. And so they locked away from the human mind part of that which they had already dredged out of the darkness of ignorance. We Jews insisted on the democracy of learning. We insisted from the very beginning that what Amos said, or what Moses said, or what Job said, or what anyone else said, belonged to the whole people. We trusted you to make up your minds, to come to some reasonable understanding of what religion and philosophy and faith was all about. Academic freedom is a gift of the Jew to Western civilization. And what we call the turbulence of a Jewish congregation derives ultimately from this source. Your reason is God-given. No one has the right to censor materials which you may not read. You must accept and you must reject. And as a result, censorship, heresy, these are terms which do not loom large, by and large, in our Jewish tradition. And I'd like to prove this to you from the Bible itself. If you'll turn to the second last book of the Bible, to the book of Nehemiah, to chapter 8. We'll read. Now let me place this chapter in time. In the year 586, the Babylonians came down and they conquered Jerusalem, they razed Judea, and they took almost all of the Jews captive into exile in Babylon. 50 years later, in the year 536, a few Jews were allowed to trickle back to Canaan, to the Holy Land, to reestablish a community. About 100 years later, 90 years actually, there was a major movement of return by some of the leadership of the Babylonian community under two men, Ezra and Nehemiah. Nehemiah was the courtier, the political leader. Ezra was the spiritual, the religious leader. Now, Ezra and Nehemiah brought with them large number of settlers to Jerusalem. They brought with them the silver plate, which had once been in the temple compound. They brought with them enough money for a building fund, and they began to build the walls. Ezra left the building to Nehemiah. Ezra was concerned with reestablishing the rites and the practices and the teachings of Judaism. And he assembled all the people of Jerusalem, and that's all there were in Palestine in those days, probably a few hundred souls, into Jerusalem, and this is the account of what happened. And when the seventh month was come, and the children of Israel were in their cities, all the people gathered themselves together as one man into the broad place that was before the water gate. And they spoke unto Ezra the scribe to bring the book of the law of Moses, which the Lord had commanded to Israel. And Ezra the priest brought the law before the congregation, both men and women. This is important because we Reformed Jews depended upon this sentence to give you women rights about 100 years ago. For 2,000 years, the rabbis just skipped over this sentence, and we brought it back, for better or for worse. And Ezra the priest brought the law before the congregation, both men and women, and all that could hear with understanding, upon the first day of the seventh month. And he read therein before the broad place, it was before the water gate, from early morning until midday, in the presence of the men and the women, and of those that could understand, and the ears of all the people were attentive unto the book of the law. And Ezra the scribe stood upon a pulpit of wood, which they had made for the purpose, and beside him stood a number of men, whose names are almost impossible to pronounce. And a trick in reading the Bible, when you come to a list of names like this, just skip over it, unless you do the crossword puzzles in the New York Times. And Ezra opened the book in the sight of all the people, for he was above all the people. And when he opened it, all the people stood up. And Ezra blessed the Lord, the great God, and all the people answered, Amen, Amen, with the lifting up of their hands. And they bowed their heads and fell down before the Lord with their faces to the ground. Also, even the Levites caused the people to understand the law. Here's the crucial sentence. And they read in the book, in the law of God, distinctly, and they gave the sense and caused them to understand the meaning. The Torah was read, the Torah was translated, the Torah was interpreted, and sermons were preached to make everyone understand what the Torah was driving at. And here you get the authority, the biblical authority, for every subsequent translation of the Bible, for every subsequent commentary on the Bible and interpretation, and for preaching itself. And you also get from this text in the Hebrew the word Jews generally use for the Bible. The phrase, and caused them to understand the reading, is in Hebrew, Vayavinu Bamikra. And they understood the Mikra. Mikra means meaning, means reading. Imagine this. This book is not called the printing or the writing, but in Hebrew, the reading. It has no meaning except as it is alive, as it is transmitted. Our fathers had an absolute horror of the Bible on a library shelf catching dust, brought down only to inscribe in it, you know, your daughter's wedding day and your son's bar mitzvah, and then carried by your daughter on her wedding day itself. The Bible is not a good luck charm. It's not a talisman. The Jew never swore on the Bible. It's not an oath-taking device. It's a source of teaching. It's a source of learning. It is something to be read out and to be communicated. Now, when Ezra caused the Torah to be read out, not all the books that are in our Bible today had yet been written. And this is an important fact to keep in mind. We call this the Bible. May I humbly say to you, that's an awful word, because it's singular. It implies a single volume. It comes originally from the Greek, from the word Biblos, which means the books. The S somehow got lost. And we have the sense, when we talk of the Bible, that it's a single whole, a unity. The Bible is 39 separate books of varying qualities and of varying kinds. And when someone says to you, I believe the Bible, he's talking arrant nonsense. Because the Bible doesn't believe itself in that sense. The last two books of the Bible, 1st and 2nd Chronicles, are nothing more than a court record of the genealogies of kings and Levites and high priests. It makes no pretense at being anything else. It makes no claim at being sacred or holy or moral or ethical or anything of that kind. It's nothing more or less than a transcript of the acts of the courts of the kings of Judea and of Israel. The book of Proverbs is nothing more or less than a collection, an anthology of worldly wisdom, of what rabbis answered when they were addressed the way Dear Abby is addressed today. Now, they weren't quite as smart or as glib as Dear Abby. They were a little more profound. But it makes no claim to be a holy book. The Song of Songs is nothing more than an anthology of love poetry. It makes no claim at being holy, sacred. These were the songs that were sung at the wedding feast in ancient Israel. Nothing more and nothing less. Subsequent interpretation gave them a sacredness, but in their origin, and to be understood, we have to understand them as separate books. And we have to recognize always that this is a misleading volume, because it is an anthology. If you want to remember what the Bible is, think of it as it was originally used and written. And fortunately, we have good information now to that score. All of you have seen in one publication or another the scrolls that have come out of the caves around the Dead Sea. And you know that they were simple parchment rolls, very much like our Torah, except they didn't have the rolling pins around them. And each book of the Bible had its separate roll. And they were kept separately. And it wasn't until about the second century of the Common Era, 400 years after the last line of the Bible had been written, that anybody thought of putting the whole thing together into a Bible canon. There were reasons for it there. They needed to define what was normative and what was heterodox. But originally, these were a series of separate books, and each one must be understood in its own terms. And sometimes we have a confusion also that two books were simply sewn together. The prophet Isaiah had sown to it some 25 chapters from another prophet. We've forgotten that prophet's name. But we know from the text that he lived at least 300 years after Isaiah. But simply because the two books were sewn together by some stitcher in ancient Israel, we have now a book of Isaiah of two and three and maybe more parts. But the original scrolls were separate books. They were separate books, and the original Bible was a library, an anthology. The word Bible then is a misleading word, and the word Holy Scriptures, which this still has, is a misleading word. At least it's plural. But the holy makes it sound as though the entire thing is holy. I prefer, as in many things, the ancient way in which our people describe the Bible. And that was with three abbreviations, three single letters. They called it the Tanakh. T-N-K. Tanakh. Which stood for Torah, Nevi'im, Ketubim. Torah, you know. It's what we have in our ark. It means, briefly, the five books of Moses. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. The beginning stories, the beginning myths, this Exodus from Egypt, and the body of it is the law which Moses received at Mount Sinai, and the law which he gave to Israel during the desert wanderings. The second part of the Bible, the Nevi'im, Nevi'im means simply the prophets, includes a number of historical books, Joshua, Judges, Samuel, Kings, and then the great prophetic teachings of Israel, the books that go by the name of the man who actually gave these sermons, these teachings, Isaiah, Jeremiah, Ezekiel, and so on. The Ketuvim means nothing more than the writings, an anthology, a collection of works which were more or less interesting to those who were in control of the curriculum of the synagogue. There were the great hymns of the synagogue, the Psalms. There were the mundane practical wisdom of Proverbs. There was the almost Greek dialogue of philosophy from the book of Job. There were some shorter books. There was the philosophic book of Ecclesiastes, where vanity of vanity, all is vanity. There was a Song of Songs, a love poetry. There was a book of elegiac poetry, of lamentations over the destruction of the great citadel in Jerusalem in the year 586, and so on and so on. To the Jew, the Torah was the source of it all. And your fathers and my fathers and we today believe the Torah to be the sacred part of the Bible. It is the source of law. It is the source of teaching. The Nevi'im is a composite. Insofar as in the Nevi'im you have the revelation of God through the prophets, it is sacred to our people. And it is here that you get the great definitions of morality, of ethics, of righteousness, and of justice. It hath been told thee, O man, what is good, and what the Lord doth require of thee, only to do justly, and to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God, and so on. The Ketuvim was literature, to be read as literature, not as something sacred, taboo, set aside, or holy. It was to be studied, and it was to be understood. And so we avoided a name which gave a sense of a composite, of a unity, and we used instead initials which made us recognize the composite nature. Now I'd like to go into this matter of what makes up the Bible one step further. To do so, I'd like to pass out these lists of the books of the Bible in both the Protestant, Catholic, and the Jewish tradition. I'd like to make a comment on that. Now, I think many of us labor under the belief that all religions share the Bible, all Western religions share the Bible, and that the only difference between the Protestant or Catholic Bible and the Jewish Bible is that we do not share the New Testament with them. They call ours the Old Testament, theirs the New Testament, and that has led to this belief. In part, this is true. Now, in the first column, you'll notice the books of the Bible as they appear in an ordinary printed Jewish Bible, in translation, of course. The second column, you'll notice the books as they appear in the latest and in a traditional form of the Protestant Bible, the Revised Standard Version. They are similar in number, but I would call to your attention the fact that if you look down, you'll see Joshua, Judges, and Ruth comes then next, instead of way down among the holy writings as it does with the Jews. Then you'll see that that Chronicles comes in early with Ezra and Nehemiah, Esther comes early, Job comes early, Ecclesiastes and Song of Solomon come before the prophetic books. The point that it comes out from this arrangement is simply this. The Protestant world, the Christian world, tended to look on the Bible as a continuous history of the world from creation to the end of the biblical times. A book like Ruth was put right after Judges because Ruth is set in the period of the judges. The first line of Ruth is, in the days that the judges judged, there was a famine in the land of Israel. And these two brothers and their family had to leave and go to the land of the Moabites, and there they met Ruth and Orpah, and they married, and you know the rest of the story. The point is that Ruth was considered to be an historical book, that it actually happened. The rabbis never considered Ruth to be anything more than an historical romance. And they interpreted, as we might say, sermonically, for what the story seemed to say rather than what it said on the surface. The same thing with another pious tradition. You'll notice that Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Solomon come together. The Song of Solomon is nothing more than our own Song of Songs. But it was believed by piety that Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, and the Song of Songs were all written by King Solomon. And so they bunched them together according to this piety. You notice that Jeremiah is followed by Lamentations. Jeremiah lived at the time of the destruction of the temple, and presumably, according to this ancient piety, he wrote the book of Lamentations. And so they are printed together. What I'm getting at is simply this. The Christian, traditional Christian, interpretation of the Bible has been more historical and historically oriented than the Jewish interpretation. We Jews have never insisted on the historical veracity of all that appears in the Bible. Christianity has tended to do so. We have never had, therefore, in Judaism the equivalent of Bishop Usher, who 100 years ago claimed he knew exactly the date and the hour and the minute on which the world was created. It was about 4,400 BC, because he added up all the genealogies in the Bible and tied them into a known date from history and worked backwards and came to this date. And we've never had a Scopes trial, because we've never insisted that the biblical account of the early days of the world must be taken on its literal and surface meaning. It is not meant as accurate history. It's meant to teach of the creative power of God. The 7 days of 6 days of creation, the day of rest, is written to establish the Sabbath, not to establish some scientific tradition. Judaism was never at war with Darwin or with Huxley or with any of the evolutionists, because we have never insisted that the Bible is a wholly accurate description of the early history and the prehistory of the world. Modern Christianity does not. Traditional Christianity has. This tradition is shown up, I believe, in the order in which the books are still printed within the Revised Standard Version. Now, if you move over one more column, you'll get to the Douay, which is a standard Catholic English translation. And you'll notice, first of all, that the list is longer. Now, these are simply the books of the Old Testament of our Bible, but they've added a few books. If you look down the list, you'll see they've added a book called Tobit. They've added a book called Judith. They've added a book called The Wisdom of Solomon. They've added a book called Ecclesiasticus, or The Wisdom of Ben Sirach. They've added a book called Baruch. They've added a book called First Maccabees, and they've added a book called Second Maccabees. Now, all of these books were written by Jews. All of them are Jewish literature. But they were all written by sectarian Jews, by Jews outside of the mainstream of Jewish life, or they contained ideas which the Jews didn't want to canonize, and they were put aside, put into something we call the Apocrypha. Simply a long Greek way of saying the hidden books. There are more books in the Apocrypha than those in the Catholic version. But much of this teaching is apocalyptic. It has to do with the end of days, with the coming of a Messiah. Judaism pushed these books aside, and because they were close to the Christian tradition, the Catholic Church drew them in. What I'm saying is simply this. The Jewish Bible is in spirit something different than the Protestant Bible, and in content something different than the Catholic Bible. You can't make the simple equation, the Old Testament plus the New Testament equals the Christian Bible. Now, we'd have to analyze each of these books to understand the specific reasons, but this is a fact which ought to be brought in mind. That's why it's not going to be so easy to achieve this translation of the Bible agreeable to all religions. Because to do so, someone is going to have to undo a 2,000-year belief as to what is in the Bible canon. And more than this, since every translation is an interpretation, even a 1948 or 49 English translation, Protestant English translation of the Bible, is not the same thing as a 1949 or 50 Jewish English translation in the Bible. I'll show it to you in very simple terms. In the Ten Commandments, we read one of the very in two words, Lo Tirzach. We translate it to mean, thou shalt not murder. The Protestant translation is, thou shalt not kill. Now, there's a vast difference between the two. Murder is a legal act, the unlawful taking of a life. Thou shalt not kill could lead to pacifism, could lead to vegetarianism. It can lead to many things that the original Hebrew seems not to understand. A Bible then must be understood through its original, or it has to be understood through the varying traditions of interpretation which have come from it. Let me give you another example. Turn to Isaiah chapter 7. If you look down the Jewish Publication Society list, you'll see about where it is. Isaiah chapter 7. If you have a Jewish Publication Society, it'll probably be on page 540 or 541. 486, some. That's why we have to do it by chapter and verse, because all editions are different. Beginning in verse 10, we have a rather strange prediction being made by Isaiah about the future. And the Lord spoke again unto Ahaz, saying, Ask thee a sign of the Lord thy God. Ask it either in the depth or in the height above. But Ahaz said, I will not ask, neither will I try the Lord. And he said, Hear ye now, O house of David, is it a small thing for you to weary men, that you will weary my God also? Therefore the Lord God himself shall give you a sign. Behold, the young woman shall conceive and bear a child, and shall call his name Emmanuel. Curd and honey shall he eat, and when he knoweth to refuse the evil and choose the good. And so on and so on. Now, in the Roman Catholic and in the old Protestant versions of this, we read, Therefore the Lord himself shall give you a sign. Behold, the virgin shall conceive and bear a son and shall call his name Emmanuel. And this is taken as literal biblical proof of the virgin birth, of the miraculous birth of Jesus, because it is a traditional assumption of Orthodox Christianity, and I quote now Paul, that Christ died according to Scripture, and Christ will be resurrected according to Scripture. All that happened in Jesus' life as the Christ, as the God, is prefigured in ancient biblical prophecy. If you turn on the Akron radio stations to some of these fundamentalist preachers, you'll find them proving by chapter and verse every act of Jesus' life. It's traditional Christian sermonics. They took whatever text they could find in the Bible and saw to it that these texts seem to foreshadow, to prophesy what would happen to Jesus 600, 700, 800 years hence. Now the Hebrew word is basula. There is no equivalent of basula as a meaning for virgin in ancient Hebrew. This was invented in a sense out of whole cloth. Judaism simply reads, the young woman shall conceive and bear a son. That's a literal translation. The Catholic, the old Protestant versions, the King James version will read, the virgin shall conceive and shall bear a son. The modern Protestant versions will do what the Revised Standard Version does, and they will read, the young woman shall conceive and bear a son. Then there'll be an asterisk in the text, and on the margin below the text, it'll say another reading, the virgin. So they aren't angering anybody by this translation. Now this is already, they've come a long way. And this is one of the things which is going to make it possible, we hope, for a joint, agreed-upon translation of Scripture. Because most of the liberal Protestants and some of the Catholic scholars have come to understand that their religion can stand on its own two feet, and they don't have to mine the Bible to continually find texts which prove what they say happened historically many centuries later. But until we clear the air of this kind of mistranslation, there is such a thing as a Jewish Bible. Now, we'd like to believe that this Jewish Bible is accurate. But I'm sure that if we stood on the outside, we'd find how it, too, reflects our own cultural attitudes and our own spiritual attitudes in its translation. I'd like to stop here for a moment, since the preface is over, and to let you ask whatever questions you have on this material which we've covered so far. Yes? I am referring to all Judaism, including Orthodoxy. Judaism read the Bible in the terms of what we call Midrash. Now, Midrash means interpretation. Midrash means an interpretation of the text. We had our classic interpretations of certain texts. Let me give you an example. Abraham is told to leave his ancestral home to go to